Hello, this is T. Hoffman, the Chief Business Development Officer at Baker Donaldson, Bierman, Caldwell, and Berkowitz, back with another edition of Baker Radio on NashvilleNetRadio.com, where Music City talks online. And today we've got Kelly Frey as our guest. Kelly is a shareholder in our Nashville office. He's also a member of our firm's IP and technology practice area. Kelly, thanks for coming to the show today.
T., thanks so much for having me.
Kelly, I know you've got and I'm going to say this, Kelly, I'm not going to reveal your age, but you have over 25 years of experience in the areas of media, licensing, procurement, all kinds of technology law experience. And that's kind of unique because you've been in the practice for more than 25 years. And some would say that the technology law wasn't even around 25 years ago. But I've read a lot about your bio, which is extensive. And for our listeners, if you want to see Kelly's bio, you can pull it up on www.bakerdonaldson.com and look for Kelly Frey, and that's spelled F-R-E-Y, Frey. And I know that you got started really early, in fact, back in college, working with some technology. Tell us how you chose to maintain your interest in the information technology field and some of the things that you did early on.
Well, I think that was just a really good compliment on my gray hair, T. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
You know, my father first started working with mainframe computers back in the 1960s, and so I was hanging around programmers at the time. That was when I was just...
How big were those?
These were big mainframes. These were the first installations in Nashville. These were the type of mainframes where you had to have the elevated floor and the special fire suppression system. So, you know, I would hang around these computer geeks and nerds, and I would listen to music and hang out, and when I wasn't doing anything else, you know, I would write computer code.
Are you kidding me? How old were you then?
This was when I was a teenager.
Wow. And how did you know what computer code even was?
Well, just from hanging around, you know,
you just picked it up.
Whenever I would visit my dad, that's who his friends were. And so it's sort of like when some people do crossword puzzles.
Right.
You know, I just did it for the relaxation. It came as a real shock to me that somebody can make a living doing that.
Yes.
And
a good living.
When I found that out, you know, I started saying, okay, I can turn this into a profession. So I started writing computer code for some of the local banks, did some of the first credit card processing systems. And I worked for a little company down in Memphis called Federal Express for a while,
helping them get started.
That was a great time. We were in this little hangar next to the tarmac on the Memphis airport, and we would watch all the airplanes go by, and we would program computers. It was a great way to pass the day.
Wow. I bet it was. I bet it was a fast way to pass the day as well.
It was, and it was a lot of fun, you know, and I wrote a lot of things back at that time that actually got published, and it's really interesting now to Google myself and go back and see some of the stuff is still around, because it was all new at the time. Nobody had ever done this before.
That's one of the great things about the area of law in which you practice, is that you can kind of keep reinventing yourself all the time.
Well, it is, and I've done that two or three times. So I got interested in computers, and then I decided, okay, well, I was interested in that type of technology, but I was also interested in biology. So I went to graduate school at Vanderbilt, and I decided to do hardcore. So what I did were take classes in the anatomy and physiology department at the medical school, and microbiology. And I started doing cell culture techniques and RNA transcription work. And all of this, these were completely new technologists at the time. And we really didn't have a clue what we were doing. We just thought it might be important at some point in the future.
And it turned out to be.
Well, you know, later when I got interested in the law, I decided, okay, this is really good. I can use this background. I can use the experience I've had in technology with computers and with biology. And it seems to be really helpful as far as the clients are concerned.
That's great. What a great story. And I know that you actually continued to do extensive writing, certainly, in the area of technology law. And as I told our listeners, they can find your articles listed, but it's not even all of the articles that you've written. It's just many of the articles over the last few years on your webpage. But your area is constantly evolving, as I mentioned earlier. And how on earth do you stay on top of all of these issues? I mean, it seems like every day in the news we hear about some other way that a hacker can get into a computer, for example, or some company that didn't put something in an agreement that they should have, and now all of their clients are at risk as a result of using their software. How do you stay on top of all of the changes that happen so rapidly in the technology area?
Well, I speed read.
You speed read. That's
seriously
good.
No. I read a lot. I read all sorts of books from different industries. I think it's important to read outside of your industry as well.
I agree, yes.
And then I write a lot. I taught college, and I taught some law school classes. The one thing I learned when I was doing that is that you really learn something when you have to teach it to others. So that's one reason I write so much.
I find that just writing my own speeches for myself is very helpful, because then I'm able to give a better speech because I've had to prepare the materials.
Well, exactly. You learn the subject matter, and then you have to translate very difficult concepts into plain English. We don't want any lawyer speak going on.
Right. That's exactly right. And I know that in addition to just reading, that you're involved in several groups that are involved in technology, and those aren't all just legal groups, correct?
Correct. I participate in a lot of industry groups. I participate in the Ethics and Compliance Officers Association. I do the Interactive Multimedia Association. I work with local media companies and associations. So I try to do a broad spectrum of activities.
And what do you learn when you interact with people who are outside of the legal biz, and how does that impact how you direct our clients?
Well, I learn the practical problems. So many times, if you're a lawyer, you end up talking about very arcane issues and very pointed issues. If you deal with a business person, what they're concerned about is making it through that day.
Right. Yeah. And I think it probably, and you tell me if I'm wrong, helps you to be more proactive in working with those issues because you've heard them in advance. And even if you didn't hear them from a client, you might use that scenario for an existing client or one that comes down the road.
Well, exactly. And knowing the business of the client is important in the type of law that I do. You've got to understand the practical issues. You've got to be able to translate that into the legal context.
And do you think it's important to get out there and actually visit those clients at their location? I know many lawyers, at least when I initially started practicing law over 20 years ago, you know, lawyers kind of had these immaculate conference rooms and beautiful waiting areas for clients to come and see them. But what I'm seeing more and more is our lawyers, at least at Baker Donaldson, going out and visiting the clients. Is it important to do that to understand those practical issues?
Yeah, there's nothing like a face-to-face meeting with a client. Plus, just being on site, you learn all sorts of things. So, for example, in my area, technology, security is a real issue, and you never know how your client is going to approach security. So I have some clients, when I walk in, before you can go past the front door, you have to sign a non-disclosure agreement.
Wow. So they don't want anybody to get in there and find out some secrets and then use those somewhere. It's competitive.
It is competitive, and you don't know that unless you visit. No one would ever just offer up that information.
That's interesting. Now, I know that you've written, I would say, prolifically over the last 5 years on a wide variety of topics. And one of the topics that I found when I Googled you and saw this on your bio was the Hannah Montana story. And it's I Want My Hannah Montana. It was an article written for the Tennessee Bar Association, the Bar Journal. Tell us a little bit about this particular issue. We only have about 2 minutes, so tell us about the issue and why it was important.
Well, yeah, this was a great opportunity to work with one of our brilliant young summer associates there at Baker. There is this whole business model that's set up based upon ticket brokers whose business model is to design and use software to go in and buy blocks of tickets when tickets first go on sale to a venue.
Right.
This came up during a Miley Cyrus concert where all the tickets were bought out within 2 minutes of the ticket sales opening. So some of the states have actually addressed this issue, and I decided they would make a great article to work with one of our associates on and try to look at how different states approach this problem. At first, there really wasn't a lot of response, and I thought, well, is anybody reading this?
Yeah, is anybody reading my great idea?
But then just this last week, I heard that Miley Cyrus had changed the way she does her ticket sales.
Great. So you've had an impact.
You know, I'd like to think that I influenced that in some way. So now, if you buy a ticket to one of her venues, you've got to present an ID, and it's an electronic ticket. And that just means that these wholesale brokers can't scarf up all the tickets and resell them.
I've actually been reading a lot on the Ticketmaster website about paperless tickets, which is exactly what you're talking about. I think it's become an issue. I know we have a concert coming up in Nashville that Keith Urban is doing as a charity event, and exactly the same thing happened. In less than 20 minutes, all the tickets, over 16,000, were sold.
Well, that's the worst thing for a performer. You don't want your real supporters to lose out on those performance
tickets. Especially for a charity event. And in fact, some of the scalpers were already selling the tickets in advance of the tickets having gone on sale. So they somehow knew they were going to get part of that block of tickets. So I think that it's something that is certainly going to change and evolve. And I think your article is going to have an impact on some of the changes that are made in the future, certainly for more artists in addition to Miley Cyrus. Kelly, we're going to come back in the next segment, and we're going to talk a little bit more about how you worked in-house and kind of your in-house experience. We'll be back in just a minute at Baker Radio at NashvilleNetRadio.com, where Music City talks online.